Blog Talk Radio.
Busy. I mean, I guess I usually don't have enough time to get to all the stories. Today I definitely don't because I have two extra from a normal day, the overwhelming majority of which will be a breakdown of the Republican debate. But there's some other stuff sprinkled in there as well. It occurs later on for Veterans Day and some other things. So I don't know, should I even bother giving you teases or should we jump right into it to try to get in as much as humanly possible? I think we'll do that. So let's do it. All right, so time for the Fox Business GOP debate breakdown. This was the fourth Republican debate, I think. I want to give you my personal breakdown. Then I'm going to give you the information that we have so far from the snap polls that came out directly after the debate. Granted, these are unscientific, but, you know, you do get some kind of sense as to what people are feeling about it. So, my own take. I think Rand Paul knocked it out of the park yesterday. Now, there's still a giant question mark as to how much this is going to help him because, I mean, he was polling at, what, an average of 2% before the debate? So, is he going to get a giant bump to 4%, 5%? And I'm not saying this to be a smug asshole and just be dismissive, but I'm genuinely curious as to how this is going to help. And also, I'm curious if, you know, this is just my own bias coming into play here where I like the stuff that he said on foreign policy. I like the fact that he was true to his libertarian streak yesterday and, you know, your average Republican voter might see it differently. But even putting that aside, I think he had a better debate performance yesterday. He started off a little slow, but then once he got into foreign policy and, you know, found his footing in the debate, he was strong. He was strong. And you get the sense that in the previous debates, he wasn't himself and he was listening to everybody who was telling him what to do. And this debate, it looks like he said, fuck that, I'm just going to be myself. And he appeared to be very principled up there. And he looked a little bit like his dad. Now, that's probably not good for his chances of winning the nomination, but nonetheless, at least he was being honest, and I think he will do better in the polls when he stays true to that, stays true to his libertarian roots, and it makes himself look different than the rest of the people up there on stage. So I think he won the debate. I'm not so convinced that other people in the Republican base are going to see it that way, but nonetheless, that's still my takeaway. Then I think Rubio came in second. Now, Rubio was incredibly plastic and very fake and being just your typical cheesy politician. But that's actually why I think he did well in this debate. Because as much as my reaction when I watched that is just revulsion, you have to keep in mind, guys, that John McCain got through the primary in 2008. And then you had Mitt Romney who got through in 2012. Now, what do those guys have in common? They were some of the more moderate people on stage. I know it's relative and the Republicans are all crazy right-wing, but they were the more moderate people on stage, and they were most like kind of classic politicians, especially Mitt Romney. I mean, he's a human Ken doll. Marco Rubio is a human Ken doll. And Romney was able to survive in 2012 to get through the primary, and Rubio's looking like the establishment fallback candidate now. When we started out, it was Scott Walker, Jeb Bush, and Marco Rubio, and obviously Scott Walker dropped out because he had -8 people supporting him. Looks like Jeb Bush is on the ropes, and we'll get to that later. So the only person left is Scott Walker, and then maybe you have the establishment considering somebody like Fiorina or Kasich as well, but maybe even less so now, or certainly I think Kasich less so now. But Marco Rubio looks like the establishment fallback, and he's playing that role where he's going to hang in there. until the end, and then hopefully when people get in the voting booth, in his mind, well, they're going to go, oh, okay, Trump, it was fun, but it was like a fling, it's a one-night stand. You know, Carson, we like him, but he's crazy. This is your average Republican voter I'm talking about here. But who, let's get serious. Who am I going to vote for? I guess I'll vote for Marco Rubio. So I have him in second. Trump, I have third. Trump, I have third because he's Trump, and it's almost like he goes into all these debates with a giant lead to begin with because the Republican base just loves everything Trump. And although his debate performance was not that strong, it's almost irrelevant because, like I said, he enters every debate with a given lead. They just like him, and everybody's looking for the things that he says that they agree with. And as a result of one form or another of confirmation bias, I think he got third. Then I have Fiorina in fourth. She annoyed me, but what else is new? I have Ted Cruz after that, so Ted Cruz in fifth here. He messed up at a couple parts and had a Rick Perry moment. We'll get to that later. But I have him in basically the middle of the pack here. Then I have Kasich, who he hasn't really had a very good debate performance since the first debate, in my opinion. Then I have Ben Carson, who I apparently like nothing Ben Carson's ever done because he really does strike me as human Valium. I mean, the guy is just Xanax through and through. He seems like he's sleeping when he talks. He's always saying things that make absolutely no sense. So I have him towards the bottom. But again, that might my bias might be playing into that a little bit. And then dead last, I have Jeb Bush. I'm very close to saying just he's totally done. I mean, he really is like Scott Walker. And he's reminding me also of Tim Pawlenty. Remember Tim Pawlenty? He ran for president, I think it was in 2012, for roughly 8.4 seconds, and then he dropped out. The establishment loved him, and they said, oh my God, he's going to be the guy that we need to support. And then when, you know, actual people looked at him, it was just hopeless. I mean, you dish napkins have a better personality than Tim Pawlenty, and it looks like the same for Jeb Bush. He's just struggling. There were some times where he tried to be aggressive and assert himself, and you could tell that his campaign staffer told him to do that because he needed to make a statement to do better in the polls. And every time he did it, it didn't smell right. It smelled funky. You can sense that this is not his personality. This is not who he is. And then one time, like, Kasich interrupted him, and he's like, you've had enough time to speak. You spoke twice, so now I'm going to speak. I only got 4 minutes in my last debate. And then Kasich's like, okay, anyways, yeah, just shut up. And then Kasich goes on to make a point, and Bush is like, sitting there quiet. Dude, you can't do your, you know, strong man assertion and then fall back, because then you're not being a strong man. I was tweeting about it. He seemed like a lost deer fawn, like a baby deer, you know, that shakes and just looking around, shit, like anything's about to attack it. That's what Jeb Bush looked like. It was just sad to watch. So I have him in dead last. Now, putting aside my own takeaway from this, because that's irrelevant. Remember, I said the last debate that I actually thought Mike Huckabee had a fantastic debate. And I thought that, who was the other one? Chris Christie had a fantastic debate the last time around. But it turns out that the people, or the, at least the people who were taking part in the snap polls, totally disagreed with me, so much so that they were both demoted to the undercard debate. So for this one yesterday. So my take is largely irrelevant. I just throw it out here because I'm a jackass and I want to give my opinion. But now let's get to the stuff that actually matters. So this is all the information we have right now in terms of snap polls. When you go to Slate, Trump wins, 37% are for Trump. Rand Paul gets second, so there we go. All right, my take apparently has, you know, some people online who would agree with it. Rand Paul gets 26%, Rubio with 11, Cruz with 8, Kasich with 5, Fiorina with 3, Bush with 1. All right, so the overall debate takeaway from others is not, you know, dissimilar from mine. And by the way, that was the case also with the first two debates. It was just the last one where my take was radically different from the people who, you know, responded to the polls. But in the first two, my take was similar. All right, now let's go to Drudge. Drudge has Trump 35.1%, massive victory. Cruz in second with 23% or 24%. Paul with 15%. Again, Rand Paul doing better. Rubio with 14%. Carson with 5%. Fiorina with 4%. Kasich with 2%. Bush with 1%. Whew. Bush is just getting absolutely walloped and trounced everywhere. So again, takeaway from the Drudge poll, somewhat similar to mine. As you can see, Trump's still destroying everybody because apparently he doesn't even need to perform. He just needs to say, Mom, Donald Trump, make America great. And everybody's like, oh, yeah, he wins by a mile. And then we have, what was the last one here? Fuck, I don't have the source for it. And I it would take me a while to look it up right now. But I have one more poll here to share with you guys. We have Trump at 40%, Ben Carson at 5%, Marco Rubio 16%, Jeb Bush 2%, Ted Cruz 7%, Fiorina 4%, Kasich 5%, Paul 21%. That's in no particular order, by the way. But there you have it. Again, that's a similar takeaway to me. We have Donald Trump with a crushing victory. I had him in third, but these guys have him crushing victory. Paul second, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz. So you're starting to see some patterns here. You're starting to see some people emerge from the field, and you're also starting to see that Donald Trump may cruise through the primary. I mean, it's painful to say. I'm trying to stop myself as I'm saying it, but every single snap poll so far that we've ever covered in all four debates has him winning. And then most polls that are scientific that come out a few days later have Trump winning in all these debates. So it looks like it's real, and it looks like a little bit more than that Newt Gingrich charge that happened last time around with Mitt Romney. Now, is it really gonna last? I mean, that's the question, and I don't know the answer to that. Because other argument here is, if you go back and look at who was leading in the 2004 primary season and the 2008 primary season, you see very quickly that Rudy Giuliani had a gigantic lead at this point back then. And then in 08, Herman Cain had a lead. Not a gigantic lead, but a lead at this time then. So it's still possible that, you know, guys like Carson are going to fall off. In fact, I think he's definitely going to fall off soon. He can't maintain. But for Trump, I don't know. It's more of a 50-50 proposition, and he might stay in the lead longer. He might actually win overall. But to me, the guy who you really have to look out for now is Marco Rubio, because he's doing everything that he has to do as the establishment candidate. He's raising all the big money, so he's going to get his name out there more. And in every debate, he's like number two or three or at worst like four. And that's all you got to do to be the establishment fallback. I mean, remember, with Mitt Romney, he was lagging behind all the time, and then eventually the base voters were like, whatever, I'll hold my nose and vote for him because I'm not going to vote for the other people. It looks like Mr. Classic Ken Doll slimy politician is going to be the one who's still hanging in there at the end. But that's my overall debate breakdown here, and it's going to be very interesting to see what happens from here on out. Okay, now, let's get to some specific clips. We got plenty of them for you. And we're going to kick it off with the opening of the debate. If I can find the fucking clip. Oh, here it is. I got 8 trillion clips around here. The opening question at the Fox Business Republican debate last night was on the minimum wage. Here are some of their answers.
Are you sympathetic to the protesters' cause, since a $15 wage works out to about $31,000 a year?
I can't be, Neil, and the reason I can't be is that we are a country that is being beaten on every front, economically, militarily. There is nothing that we do now to win. We don't win anymore. As far as the minimum wage is concerned, people need to be educated on the minimum wage. Every time we raise the minimum wage, the number of jobless people increases.
So, sir, just to be clear, you would not raise it?
I would not raise it. That every country in the world has rich people. What makes America special is that we have millions and millions of people that are not rich, that through hard work and perseverance are able to be successful. The problem is that today people are not successful working hard as ever because the economy is not providing jobs that pay enough. If I thought that raising the minimum wage is the best way to help people increase their pay, I would be all for it, but it isn't. In the 21st century, it's a disaster.
It's a disaster to raise the minimum wage. Guys, this is unbelievable. When I was watching this, I was tweeting about how they're so deep in their bubble that they can't see straight. I mean, there are polls that show that 80% of the American people are for raising the minimum wage. 80%. There are polls that have even a majority of Republicans are like, yeah, raise the minimum wage. So when they give answers like this, they're pleasing nobody but the establishment, but the corporations, but the billionaires, but the business owners and the elites. And, you know, if you wonder, well, why is it that the Republicans have been doing shitty in national elections recently, especially presidential elections? Well, there's your answer. I mean, one thing is the George Bush effect and the neocon effect. Nobody liked his administration, so that had a lot to do with it. But also because they say shit like this, where, you know, in their mind, they're like, well, I'm going to keep it real here, and I'm going to, like, represent people when I say this. But in reality, you're not keeping it real, and you're not representing anybody. Even a majority of your own base says raise the minimum wage. So it's stuff like this that where Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are watching it and laughing and going, oh, my God, you're just trying to hand over the election to us. And virtually everything they said there was incorrect. So PolitiFact looked into Ben Carson's statement about how, oh, unemployment rises when you raise minimum wage. That's not true. They've raised it in some localities and at the state level in some places, and unemployment didn't go up. Now, could that be true if they raise the minimum wage tomorrow to $50 an hour? Of course, because then you have small businesses that can't afford to pay people $50 an hour, so they're going to have to lay you off. But that's not what happens. And when we talk about minimum wage increases, we're universally talking about modest increases that just pay people a living wage. And it turns out that the studies have shown and the data proves that that does not increase unemployment. So that's just a cop-out argument. And then Trump says, well, I can't sympathize with them. A billionaire saying, I can't sympathize with a minimum wage worker. Incredible. He says, because we're being beaten economically. So your solution to being beaten economically is to keep wages super low? Well, then we're winning at the expense of what? Quality of life for the American people? For the working poor? That's not winning. But see, what he means is, like, he wants to beat Bangladeshi factory workers. You know, like a teenage girl working in a factory in Bangladesh making shit and, you know, making 19 cents an hour, whatever the fuck it is. He's like, well, we got to bring the jobs back here somehow. Pay them like 17 cents an hour here and get them back here. No, but Donald, there are ways to actually have a high quality of living and, you know, stop doing free trade altogether, so-called free trade. Stop outsourcing altogether. All you need is the government to set up the right policies to say, we're going to tax you if you send your company overseas and you have people in Mexico or wherever make the products. There are ways to do this without driving wages down in the United States of America. And then Marco Rubio says, well, America is special because this is a place where people can work hard and not be rich. Like, and I assume what he's saying, if I'm being kind, is, well, you can work hard and be middle class here, and that's what makes us special. As if America is the only place that has a middle class. He said that's what makes America special. Hello? I mean, I don't know if you've seen the statistics recently, but the American dream is no longer really the American dream. It's now the Canadian dream. They're beating us in terms of economic mobility, moving up that economic ladder and doing better than your parents' generation. They're ahead of us now. Scandinavia's been kicking our ass here, too, where there's a much better chance that, you know, you'll have a decent quality of living and you'll be comfortably middle class if you're there. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that they have a social democratic system where, you know, education bills are off the table, healthcare bills are off the table. The tax money actually goes to them, to the citizens. I know, a crazy fucking idea. But look at this stuff, man. And they're all totally oblivious to the facts, too, that if you raise the minimum wage along with the increase that the top 1% had, the minimum wage would be over $22 today. If you just kept it up with productivity, it'd be about $21 today. If you kept it the same as it was in 1968 and simply accounted for inflation, so the exact same wage as 1968, it'd be about $10.10 today. So by every measure, the minimum wage workers are getting screwed. And here you have Republicans who are on the record now. I'm not in favor of the working poor. I'm not. So now you know when they talk about cutting taxes and looking out for the little guy, the average Joe, They're not talking about you. When they talk about cutting taxes and helping out the little guy, they're really talking about the upper middle class and the rich, the top 10% maybe. Because here they have an opportunity, a softball down the center of the plate to say, you're with the working poor people, and they say, no, fuck them. You know, yay, wage slavery. So you're in favor of people working full-time jobs and not making enough money to survive. Thank you for doing your best to hand the election over to Democrats. All right, now, let me do one more here. And this one will be Trump and the TPP. And we'll take our first break and we'll come back with a lot more. Donald Trump was caught speeding, talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. Let's watch.
Why would you reverse more than 50 years of the U.S. trade policy?
The TPP is a horrible deal. It is a deal that is going to lead to nothing but trouble. It's a deal that was designed for China to come in, as they always do, through the back door and totally take advantage of everyone. It's 5,600 pages long, so complex that nobody's read it. It's like Obamacare. Nobody ever read it. They passed it. Nobody read it. And look at the mess we have right now, and it will be repealed. But this is one of the worst trade deals, and I would, yes, rather not have it. With all of these countries and all of the bad ones getting advantage and taking advantage of what the good ones would normally get, I'd rather make individual deals with individual countries. We will do much better. We lose a fortune on trade. The United States loses with everybody.
Hey, George, you know, we might want to point out China's not part of this deal.
Yeah.
True. It's true. Yeah.
Okay. That's
but
right.
Burn, Trumposaurus Rex. You got wrecked. As they say on the internet, R-E-K-T, wrecked. Yeah, that may be one of the reasons why Rand Paul did very well in this debate. Why even the Snap polls say, yeah, he did very well in this debate. That's pretty devastating, because he does say at one point there that, oh, this deal is designed for China, as they usually do, to come in the back door, and which, pause on that, and beat us economically. So, obviously, score one for Rand Paul there. But actually, did kind of annoy me, though, this whole segment, because Trump is actually, in the macro picture, correct. I mean, he's obviously wrong that China's not part of the TPP. Rand is right to say China's not part of the TPP. But everything else he's saying there is true. The spirit of what he's saying is true. That all these trade deals really do screw over America. All these trade deals leave us with a terrible trade deficit. You're screwing over the American workers. You're, in reality, sacrificing the good of the American people to the corporatocracy. Everything else there was true. And I just fear that because Rand's point is so utterly devastating and correct, that people will, like, dismiss the rest of what Trump was trying to say there. And they'll think, like, yeah, obviously you should be for the TPP. No, you shouldn't. Trump's actually right on that. Now, when you dig deeper, of course, Trump may also be wrong in the sense that he goes on to bring up, well, I just do different trade deals. I do them with specific individual nations, and I'm a good negotiator, so I'd get a good deal. But in reality, the answer is don't do any of them. The answer is protectionism. I know that's a dirty word in American politics today, but it's really not among the people. It only is among the establishment and among the elite and among Washington and New York. Because the way it works right now, whether it's NAFTA or CAFTA or GATT or the WTO or permanent normal trade relations with China, we have lost millions and millions of jobs and good factory jobs and manufacturing jobs, and we've gutted the middle class, screwed over minority communities who were starting to do decently when they had those opportunities. But since we shipped all the jobs to Bangladesh and Mexico and elsewhere, yeah, that is a problem, and we do need to fix that. And the biggest issue that led to that is money in politics. So, yes, Rand Paul won that exchange, but in terms of the macro picture here, Trump bitching about the TPP is justified and right. Now, of course, he's probably ranting against it for all the wrong reasons, and he really doesn't know the details, as you could tell, because he thinks China's involved with it. But nonetheless, that sentiment is something that the American people should hear, and they should just get somebody who crystallizes that picture better for them and explains it in more detail and tells them what the real problem with it is. So overall, score one for Rand Paul there. He wrecked him. But at the same time, the sentiment behind what Trump is saying there is actually right, which is that the trade deals have been screwing over the American people, and they should be, and according to the polls, they are totally against them. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, Carly Fiorina, we introduce her, and we also have Marco Rubio and Rand Paul go at it, and a whole bunch of other stuff. Stay right there, guys.
Dealing with you for 3 motherfucking months. You ain't the driver in front of me. Yeah. So what you saying? Thank you, 5-0. 5-0. There ain't no motherfucking time. We ain't this motherfucking thing. Tonight, I hear that. Shit. Need. Need. Come on, man. Got me. Shit. Shit. Shit.
Let's move on to Carly Fiorina. She had a few ridiculous moments. I'm going to get to one now. I'll do another one a little bit later. But, man, she's totally substanceless. No substance whatsoever. But I feel like the way that she talks is going to appeal to some people in the Republican base, because she's very condescending to the moderators, and it basically focuses all of her attention when she talks on Hillary Clinton, and she says, oh, she's horrible, and I could beat her, and blah, 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 blah. So that's why she's done, like, middle of the pack, I would say, overall, when you talk about all these debates so far. Carly Fiorina spoke about repealing Obamacare last night, and what she wants to replace it with is comical.
Just to be clear, you said you would repeal Obamacare, but what is the alternative? And
what
how does that help small business?
To give the alternative is to allow states to manage high-risk pools for those who really need help. Look, I'm a cancer survivor, okay? I understand that you cannot have someone who's battled cancer just become known as a pre-existing condition. I understand that you cannot allow families to go bankrupt if they truly need help. But I also understand that Obamacare isn't helping anyone. We're throwing more and more people into Medicaid, and fewer doctors are taking those payments. The point is Obamacare is crushing small businesses. It is not helping the families it was intended to help. So let us allow states to manage high-risk pools. Let us try the one thing in health insurance we've never tried, the free market. Let us ensure that as patients and customers, we have the information to shop wisely for our health care.
All right, that really gets under my skin. She says she's a cancer survivor, and then she goes on to say at the end there, we need to try the free market. Carly, that's the system that we had beforehand, which necessitated reform, where we got Obamacare. Now, I prefer a Medicare for All system, or at the very least, we should have gotten a public option. We didn't get any of that stuff. So we did the right-wing reform proposal, which was still better than nothing, but it is right-wing, of Obamacare, the individual mandate system, expanding Medicaid. And she's like, no, free market. Well, that was the problem. The problem was free market. And Carly, you contradicted yourself because apparently you don't understand that in a true free market, there are going to be pre-existing conditions, and the insurance companies can reject you for that. That's what a free market is. You need the government to step in and say you're not allowed to reject people for pre-existing conditions for them to not do it. Left on their own, they're obviously going to reject anybody who they think is a really high risk. Now, this is where her high-risk pool idea comes in, where she says, well, the states can deal with high-risk pools, and that would, among the people who are, you know, the worst investment, so to speak, that would take care of them. Okay, but what about everybody else, Carly? What about when you're not a high risk, but you do get cancer out of nowhere? What then? How about that person? In the free market system, you're screwed if you didn't already have health care. And even if you did have health care, under the system we had, you could still go bankrupt. And actually, we still have that problem today under Obamacare. I mean, you can pay your premiums every month, and you can have a gold plan, a great plan, but then, you know, when you actually get cancer, get some sort of horrific illness, you get a giant bill. So think about that. You pay your premiums every month. And then when something bad happens, they go, no, that's totally cool. You pay the first $15,000, and then we'll come in and help you. Well, then why the fuck have I been paying the premiums all along? No, but guys, this is a private insurance system. This is what's going to happen in a private insurance and a private healthcare system. Everything is for profit. And since you determine that people's health is for profit, you've set up a perverse incentive. Now, I'm not totally anti-capitalist in the sense that, you know, I don't think there's some areas and many areas where the profit motive makes sense. But when it comes to life or death situations, when it comes to health care and health insurance, you shouldn't have the profit motive involved, because think about it. What does the insurance company want to spend their money on? What do they want to spend their money on? Well, they're going to want to, like any corporation would, because they have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders to do so, they're going to want to take that money, pad the bottom line. They're going to want to make profit. So how do you make more profit? Deny care as much as possible. That's the problem. It's a fundamental, it's a systemic problem in a private insurance and a private health care system. And Carly Fiorina is acting like we never tried that shit before. We had nothing but that until recently. Sure, we have the VA for veterans, we have Medicare for older people, Medicaid for the poorest people, but the middle class is getting fucking screwed. The middle class and the middle age, they're getting totally screwed. They're getting hammered. We pay more for health care in the U.S. than anywhere around the world, and we get worse outcomes. So she's just wrong in what her proposal is. She wants to go back to the system where 45,000 people died every year because they didn't have access to basic health care. That's her solution. And then let me just close on this here. She says, Obamacare isn't helping anyone. And what's hilariously ironic is that later on in the debate, she goes on to say Hillary Clinton lies all the time. Well, you were called out for roughly 18 lies in the past few debates. And that's the clearest lie I've ever seen. I know because Obamacare helped me. Again, I'm not even the biggest fan of Obamacare. I wish we had a Medicare for All system, or I wish we had a public option. But Obamacare helped me in that, you know, what I do here, this is a small business, essentially. You know, I'm an entrepreneur of sorts. And I didn't have health insurance through an employer because I don't have an employer. I mean, I'm an affiliate with TYT, but they're not my employer. I'm an affiliate, so I'm my own thing that's linked up with them. So I don't have insurance, so what was I going to do? Before Obamacare, flat out, guys, it simply would have been too expensive for me to get any insurance, except the catastrophic kind, which means that if anything happens to me, unless I'm on the verge of death, they're not going to cover anything. And even if I am on the verge of death, they'll cover some of it, and I still got to pay a tremendous amount of it. So I couldn't afford any health insurance. With Obamacare, it made it affordable for me. So when you say some dumb shit like Obamacare isn't helping anyone, that's just not true. There are an endless line of people. There are people whose kids had their lives saved as a result of this. There are people who, from the Medicaid expansion, had their lives saved as a result of this. I mean, it's egregious in how they talk about this and how they frame it and how they have a brazen disregard for truth. All right, now, we'll get to some really, really meaty stuff here. Rand Paul and Marco Rubio went at it, son. This was, this back and forth was hot on Twitter. This also may be one of the reasons why people said Paul won the debate. Rand Paul and Marco Rubio went at it over military spending. Let's watch.
The family is the most important institution. Nevertheless, it's
and yeah, I do want to rebuild the American military. I know that Rand is a committed isolationist. I'm not. I believe the world is a stronger and a better place when the United States is the strongest military power in the world.
Marco, how is it conservative? How is it conservative to add $1 trillion expenditure for the federal government that you're not paying for? How is it conservative? How is it conservative to add $1 trillion in military expenditures? You cannot be a conservative if you're going to keep promoting new programs that you're not going to pay for.
My name is Congressman. We can't even have an economy if we're not safe. There are radical jihadists in the Middle East beheading people and crucifying Christians. A radical Shia cleric in Iran trying to get a nuclear weapon. The Chinese taking over the South China Sea. Yes, I believe the world is a safer... No, I don't believe. I know that the world is a safer and better place when America is the strongest military power in the world.
I don't think we're any safer. I do not think we are any safer from bankruptcy court. As we go further and further into debt, we become less and less safe. This is the most important thing we're going to talk about tonight. Can you be a conservative and be liberal on military spending? Can you be for unlimited military spending and say, oh, I'm going to make the country safe? No, we need a safe country. But, you know, we spend more on our military than the next 10 countries combined. I want a strong national defense, but I don't want us to be bankrupt.
All right, so that was a great back and forth. Obviously, needless to say, on the substance, Rand Paul was 100% correct, and he knocked it out of the park. And I even like the argument that he made where he, like, is kind of inherently jabbing liberals, where he's like, you know, you can't be a conservative and say you want unlimited spending on programs you can't afford. You can't, even if it's the military, that's, you can't be a liberal on that. So he's framing it as if you want to spend a lot on military, you're a liberal. Now, that's not true, but I still think it was a good argument, and it's an argument that maybe might help him in a conservative primary where he's still being principled in his anti-war stance, but he's framing it as if it's okay if you're a conservative, guys, and you don't want to go into stupid wars. So, you know, you could be with me on this. And also, he's not wrong either. So it also is a conservative position to say strong national defense and to do the stupid blank checks that they do. But then there is an argument, a conservative argument, for non-interventionism. It's paleoconservatism. It was a common position, especially before the neocons went in there and wrecked everything. You know, being a conservative, being anti-war, those things were not mutually exclusive. You can be that, and Rand Paul's providing that alternative. Now, again, on the substance, Rand Paul won there. But in terms of the takeaway from the Republican base, unfortunately, I got to say it's a split decision. And I think being a little too kind to Rand Paul when I say that, because judging by the applause in the room, most people there were with Marco Rubio, even though he was saying utter nonsense. I take no pleasure in saying that. I wish that wasn't the case. I think Rand Paul's a trillion times better than Marco Rubio. But you got to call it out for what it is, man. You know, this is an argument where Rand can make it resonate to a certain extent in the Republican base, but isn't enough where he's going to get the majority. And it's a fair point, as people have pointed out to me before. They say, well, the room is not indicative of, you know, the rest of the Republican base voters. So you really don't know if the applause in the room is something that you should weigh heavily. Fair enough. But still, overall, I'm going to say Rand is right on the substance. And in terms of how it's going to play out in the minds of your average Republican voter, I'm going to call that a split decision. But now, let me break it down further. So I like how Rubio just tried to smear Rand right off the bat, where Rubio said, Rand is a committed isolationist. This is the new, you know, phrase that people use, the new term people use, when they want to not address the substance of your points, but they want to dismiss you on foreign policy. They just say, you're an isolationist. Or another one that people use, pacifist. I can't tell you how many people just, you know, smugly assert that you're some sort of pacifist and therefore they don't have to listen to your anti-American foreign policy nonsense. It's not true. There's roughly 4 isolationists in America and roughly 4 pacifists in America. I mean, those are very, very fringe positions. But what is not a fringe position is what Rand Paul actually is, non-interventionist. There's a difference. The isolationist has a negative connotation to it, and it implies that, you know, you don't want to be involved in any circumstance ever. And foreign policy, you know, interventions, militaristic or otherwise, are off the table by definition, and you never consider it. And even isolationist even has some economic implications in the word. It has such a negative connotation to it that people assume that, like, you don't want to converse with any other nations. There's all types of crazy shit attached to it. It's a loaded term. But what is non-interventionism? Non-interventionism is just the idea that we should only use U.S. military force in self-defense. That's it. And that's what I like to call a common sense position that the overwhelming majority of the American people are in favor of or would be in favor of if somebody argued for it effectively. So it's just, Rubio, it's a disingenuous, smug prick of an argument. Say, isolationist, and then he moves on. And then notice, his core argument, you heard it. What did Rubio say? Jihadists! Iran! China! Oh! And the audience like, oh, we're scared, bro! We're scared, we like you better, we think you're going to protect us more by doing more military interventions. All right, we're scared, bro. It's so funny that the conservatives like to think of themselves as the macho man party. We're strong, we're tough on defense. Meanwhile, they're clapping because they're scared little punk bitches. Look at them. Jihadists! Oh, yes, protect us from the big bad jihadists! And, you know, Rand's over there just facepalming. And there was one more thing I wanted to say here, and I can't fucking find it, of course. You can't be a conservative in the military spending. Rubio, jihadists, Iran, China. Oh, and I loved Rand Paul's point on the actual facts that go into our military spending when he said, we spend more than the next 10 countries combined. Now, if you notice, there was tepid applause when he said that. It was like, because he was using that in service of the point that we got to cut this bloated military budget. Over 50% of discretionary spending is for defense. So what the fuck? And the audience is like, we actually kind of like that. But really, that's so out of whack. Guys, we can cut our military spending by 50% and still have the biggest military in the world by a mile and a half. So Rand was super substantive there and super principled there. And unfortunately, I'm not sure just how much that resonated with the audience and with the Republican base, even though overall in this debate, he did a fantastic job. Okay. Let's do, I'm going to move to Jeb Bush now, Mr. Boring himself. I want to try to squeeze in two more before we take a break here, maybe even three. Jeb Bush spoke about foreign policy at the debate last night, and he admitted that the military-industrial complex is a thing. Now, he's not going to use, you know, that specific terminology, but pay attention at the end here, and you'll see what he's getting at. He mentions this is tied into the economy. So let's listen, then we'll break it down.
Governor Bush, what is the biggest threat facing America today?
I'd say it is Islamic terrorism. And back to the question of what we were dealing with in Iraq, when we pulled back, voids are filled. That's the lesson of history. And sadly, this president does not believe in American leadership. He does not believe it. And the net result is that we have a caliphate the size of Indiana that gains energy each and every day to recruit Americans in our own country. And the threat to the homeland relates to the fact that we've not dealt with this threat of terror in the Middle East. We should have a no-fly zone in Syria. We should have a support for the remnants of the Syrian Free Army and create safe zones. If you want to deal with the 4 million refugees that are leaving Syria because of the devastation there, then we ought to create safe zones for them to stay in the region rather than go to Europe. And that requires American leadership. Without American leadership, every other country in the neighborhood begins to change their priorities. It is tragic that you see Iraq and other countries now talking to Russia. It wasn't that long ago. Russia had no influence in the region at all. And so the United States needs to lead across the board. This president and Hillary Clinton both do not believe that the United States has a leadership role to play, and we're now paying a price, and it will have a huge impact on the economy of this country if we don't deal with this.
It will have a huge impact on the economy of this country if we don't deal with it. Okay, he's admitting there that warfare is our welfare. So we have defense contractors in all the 50 states, different plants everywhere. And, of course, we have no-bid contracts coming from Washington to Raytheon and Boeing and Halliburton and Honeywell and all these different corporations. And they have to make tanks and Kevlar vests and vehicles and anti-aircraft missiles and a trillion different things. And this helps the economy go round and round and round and round. And this is exactly what Dwight Eisenhower warned against in his farewell speech, that you can't fall into the trap of war for profit. You can't fall into the trap of relying on this to be your economic engine, because then what's going to happen? Naturally, you're just going to look for places to intervene. You're going to look for different regimes to arm. And the end result is you're going to fight needless wars, people are going to die, and you're going to arm horrific regimes, like, for example, Saudi frickin' Arabia, who we're arming right now as they massacre civilians in Yemen. But he's admitting it. That's the amazing thing, is that when the Republicans are in their bubble and they let it all hang out like they do at a Republican debate, they say shit like that. Like, yeah, no, for the economy we need to do war. Oh my God, what a perverse incentive. You've now set it up so that there's a benefit to you if you fight wars. So then you're not going to fight wars only when it's a matter of necessity and for self-defense. This is exactly what Smedley Butler warned about when he said war is a racket. And he goes on to describe, you know, you're basically fighting for the corporatocracy and for people to get rich here. And that's not a conspiratorial thing. I know it sounds like it, but follow the money and look at what's happening. It's obvious at this point, and he's even saying it. He's admitting it. All right, so you have that aspect of it, and this shows you also he's a puppet of the corporations, as we knew. That's why he's in the Bush family, and they know they trust this guy, which is why they dumped a tremendous amount of money into his campaign from the beginning. So let's address some of his other points here. He says, well, Iraq, look at Iraq. We need to learn a lesson from that. When we pull back, voids are filled. So that's the lesson he took away. Why we pull back? No, Jeb, the lesson you should have taken away was, why do we go in the first place? If we didn't go in the first place, we would have never destabilized the region, and you couldn't have had ISIS rise out of the situation. Now, some people say, well, that's not fair to say that because maybe they would have came about anyway. But we can trace exactly how ISIS came about today. And the biggest reason for their success in terms of territorial gains is because Saddam's former Ba'athist generals teamed up with them. And when they did that, they were able to be successful and get all this different territory. If you never had Saddam's Ba'athist generals team up with them, they could have never gotten all that territory. Why? Because they don't know what the fuck they're doing. They don't know how to win literal military victories. They're a bunch of religious lunatics in the middle of the desert. They need the experts to help them. And the experts would have never fucking helped them if you didn't throw out Saddam's regime, de-Ba'athify the government, and turn the country over to the Shiites and Maliki. These are the, I know it gets annoying and we're getting into the weeds, but these are the details that are so important, which show you that the Republicans have no clue what the fuck they're doing, and they want to micromanage everything, and they just always fuck everything up when they do that. So your lesson should be, my brother shouldn't have done that ridiculous, over-the-top, dumb neocon war. But no, your takeaway is we should have stayed in there longer. How long, big guy? You want to stay there forever? Don't answer that, because I know the answer might be yes. And then he says, Obama doesn't believe in America as a leader. Even though he said in his last State of the Union, the question isn't if America is going to lead, it's how America is going to lead. And Obama, in my opinion, unfortunately, still believes in a soft version of imperialism. So not the neocon shoot 'em up, go in everywhere with ground armies, invade nonsense. He says, no, just drone strikes here and there, airstrikes here and there, maybe one invasion or two. And that's supposed to be like, oh, liberal. But see, the point is, he still clearly believes in America as a leader and being the world police, which is why we're involved militarily in 7 different countries right now. How many do you want, big guy? You want to be in 12 different countries? God, it shows they view our soldiers as fucking pawns. You know, send the peasants out there to do our dirty work for the corporations. What a gross person, man. And they think they're patriots. You're not patriots. You hate our country and you hate the fucking troops. Look at how you treat them. And finally, he says, we need a no-fly zone in Syria because that would immediately escalate further into Cold War 2.0 with Russia and possibly down the line World War 3. But please, don't let facts and intelligence get in the way of, you've been Mr. Tough Guy, oh, I'm against Russia, no-fly zone, even though they're fucking bombing ISIS. Why would you want to stop them from bombing ISIS? Are you on the side of ISIS? Which leads to the final point. Support the Syrian rebels, he says. There's like 8 Free Syrian Army guys left in Syria. Those are the people who are the moderate Sunni rebels. You know who's remaining there on fighting on the side of the rebels? Islamists, jihadists, al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda branch in Syria, and ISIS. So all radical jihadis. And Bush is like, we got to support those guys. Why? Again, he wants to get involved in a civil war in Syria the same way his brother got involved in a civil war in Iraq. How did that work out? Bush, you're done, man. You know, he's at 1% he's polling at. Stop embarrassing yourself. Your ideas are just as bad as your poll numbers. I lied. I only could fit in one more before we took a break. All right, let me take that break now. When we come back, John Kasich talks about Wall Street, Ted Cruz has a Rick Perry moment, and much more, bitch. All right, stay right there.
running handy, but then by the time I find it handy to rip my heart apart and start planning my crash landing, I go up to the ceiling. Then I feel my soul start leaving like an old man's hair receding. I'm bleeding, please, oh please, on my knees repeatedly asking why it's got to be like this. Is this living free? I don't want to be the one, be the one that was the song, blood on my hands out to the moon. Take this weapon, pours in darkness, I'm sleeping, that's the harpoon.
Son of a bitch. All right, we're back, guys. And there's a 0% chance I finish everything that I have scheduled for you here. But I'll put it into hyperdrive, and we'll see how much we can get in. John Kasich has a brilliant idea on how to regulate Wall Street. Let's watch.
I'll tell you about Wall Street. There's too much greed. And the fact is, a free enterprise system is a system that's produced the greatest wealth for the world. But you know, Michael Novak, the great Catholic theologian, says that a free enterprise system that is not underlaid with values, and we should all think about the way we conduct our lives. Yes, free enterprise is great, profits are great, but there have to be some values that underlay it, and they need a good ethics lesson on Wall Street on a regular basis to keep them in check so we, the people, do not lose. Thank you.
Gerard, can I...
You want to give Wall Street ethics lessons? Catholic ethics lessons? I don't want them fucking children, please. None of that. Oh, no, I didn't. Oh, yes, I did. No, I'm joking around. Or am I? That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. Can you imagine these guys sitting in a class? All right, guys, now, Gordon Gekko was wrong. Greed is? Anybody? Anybody? Raise a hand. Anybody? David. Bad? That greed is bad. Greed is bad. Jesus is good. Jesus wasn't greedy. Jesus wasn't greedy. Now worship the old man dressed like a wizard. That'd be the Pope. An adult is in a Halloween costume. Worship him. Catholic ethics lessons for people on Wall Street. No, but see, this is why I mock Republicans. They deserve it. And that's actually probably the best proposal of anybody on stage. Because everybody else on stage is like, deregulate everything. They're the smartest guys in the room. Deregulation has never gone bad before. Let them do whatever the fuck they want. And this, he's at least, okay, now come on. Let's be reasonable here, guys. Let's not actually regulate them efficiently to prevent economic crashes and stuff. Catholic ethics lesson. Do that. Oh. All right, guys. This is why, under Republicans, the economy has done worse. Objectively, that's not just my opinion. If you tally up the private sector job creation under Republicans versus Democrats, Democrats win by a mile and a half. Because their ideas are, what's the word I'm looking for? Better. They're better ideas. So when you say deregulate and everything will be hunky-dory, you have to look at history. And we know that in the 19-teens and the 1920s, when we did massive deregulation and we cut taxes for the rich, we had the stock market crash and the Great Depression. Now, then we put the New Deal in place and we actually regulated Wall Street. And then we had decades and decades of stable growth. And then what happened? Ronald Reagan came in and dismantled all of that. And then when Reagan left office, it was a boom-bust cycle. So he deregulated, cut taxes for the rich, the economy soared, but it was all fake, and then boom, it blew up. And then we had another crash, another recession. And then at the end of Clinton's term, getting rid of Glass-Steagall, and then under Bush, we did more deregulation, and we cut tax for the rich. What happened? Subprime mortgage crisis, Great Recession in 2008. Okay. We know the lessons of history. It's just a matter of whether or not you idiots can get them through your thick head. I love how short our memory is. These guys are up there proposing all of Bush's ideas as if those weren't the ideas that led to the crash, along with Clinton and his Glass-Steagall repeal and the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act. No, it was right-wing economics, your ideas that led to the problem in the first place. And now the strongest proposal we get out of them is Kasich going, ethics lessons. Yeah, I'm sure that'll work. What a goofball. And he fucking looks like Shaggy from Scooby-Doo. I don't care what anybody says. He's an old Shaggy from Scooby-Doo. He even talks like him. Oh, zoink, Scoob. Like, no, ethics lesson, Scoob. Ah. All right, Ted Cruz and his sad, sad moment. Ted Cruz had his own Rick Perry oops moment at yesterday's debate. Let's check it out.
It's one of the very few plans that abolishes the IRS. But on top of that, today we rolled out a spending plan, $500 billion in specific cuts, five major agencies that I would eliminate, the IRS, the Department of Commerce, the Department of Energy, the Department of Commerce, and HUD. It's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education, and the, what's the third one there? Let's see. Oh, five. Okay. So, commerce, education, and
EPA?
EPA. There you go. No, okay.
Let's stop getting to this.
Seriously?
Is EPA the one you were talking about? Or?
No, sir. We were talking about the agencies of government. The EPA needs to be rebuilt.
But you
no
can't
doubt about
but
that.
You can't name the third one?
The third agency of government,
yes.
I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see. I can't. The third, sorry. Oops.
I cringe every time I watch that. It's hard to watch, just on a human level. Get commerce, department, education. I can't. Oops. Oh, Rick. Now, in defense of Ted Cruz, his wasn't nearly as bad. But notice what he did there. And I think Chris Hayes pointed this out on Twitter. He's like, you could see in Cruz's eyes for a split second that he forgot where he was and he forgot which department it was time for him to mention. So it's almost like he made a decision. Just repeat the same one and move along. Not many people are going to notice. If they do notice it, just play it smooth. Play it smooth and you'll be all right. Just don't pull a Rick Perry where you're actually searching for the answer. And it's funny because that actually shows you that Rick Perry is a more genuine person. Where he's like, he's searching for the answer, he can't find the answer, so he's like, okay, I couldn't find it, guys. I'm just going to admit that. But Rick Perry's a classic slimeball, sleazy politician. So he's like, just say the same one over and move along. Who cares? The facts, the specifics are irrelevant. If you don't know the answer, just fill in the blank with something that you already said and move along. I don't know if you caught it. Some actually, at first I wouldn't blame people if they don't catch it, but he says Department of Commerce, something else, then Department of Commerce again, and then he says HUD. And he moves along. So he actually, from a political perspective, Cruz actually played that off much better than Rick Perry. But from a human perspective, I look at Rick Perry and I go, oh, he's more honest. He couldn't come up with the answers. He's like, oops. Whereas Ted's just like, yeah, fuck it. Who cares? Fuck these idiots. I'll repeat the same one, move along, and just play it smooth, and I'll be all right. And that tells you everything about Ted Cruz. It's all calculated. That's why he's such a smarmy little prick. You know, he's playing the role of the far-right politician and trying to be a populist on the right and stuff. But the most offensive part of all this is not the fucking up and forgetting, because whatever, that happens. But it's the substance of what they're saying. Like, yeah, it's funny, we could laugh at the screw-ups. That's fine, I'm not above that, as you can tell. But when they're talking about, like Ted did, abolish the IRS, or, you know, abolish the FDA, well, that we need that to make sure our drugs don't kill us. You know, we need it to regulate our food to make sure that we don't get E. coli or salmonella and die. We need the EPA to make sure that we don't, you know, pollute the environment beyond all recognition, even though we're kind of already doing that. But we need some sort of government agency to have rules and enforce them so people don't go too far and dump chemicals in a river or something and get people sick. And abolishing the IRS, I never understood that one. Guys, so who do you want to collect the taxes? Everybody, whether it's Republicans or Democrats, everybody's in favor of some taxes because we're not anarchists or anarcho-capitalists, even the furthest right wing among us, okay? So somebody's got to collect the taxes. Who do you want to collect them? You say, not the IRS, abolish the IRS. Well, you're going to have to replace it with another agency that collects taxes. You can call it whatever you want. You can call it dipshit up my ass McGee's axe, but you got to call it something. So what do you want, unless you want Chick-fil-A to come in, what do you want, to give it to Arby's, let Arby's collect the taxes? It just, that's the thing, it doesn't make any sense. And that's the problem with these Republican policies, is that it's all showmanship right now, kabuki theater, and there's no intelligence behind it, and they're just demagoguing. My, cut all the big parts of government, like the Department of Commerce, and the Department of Commerce, and the Department of Commerce, and allow Chick-fil-A to collect the taxes, because fuck the IRS, I'm Ted Cruz, All right, now, I got one more Carly Fiorina, and then the final story of the debate will be a horrendous question. I won't sugarcoat it, from Neil Cavuto. But first, let's go to Miss Don't Know How to Answer a Question. Carly Fiorina seemed wholly incapable of directly answering a question at last night's debate. So here's a perfect example of that on the issue of the economy.
Well, you've all pointed out how weak the current recovery has been and how disappointing by any historical standards. In the general election, the Democrats will inevitably ask you and voters to compare the recent president's jobs performance. Now, in 7 years under President Obama, the U.S. has added an average of 107,000 jobs a month. Under President Clinton, the economy added about 240,000 jobs a month. Under George W. Bush, it was only 13,000 a month. If you win the nomination, you'll probably be facing a Democrat named Clinton. How are you going to respond to the claim that Democratic presidents are better at creating jobs than Republicans?
had several children. And she said to me, you know, Carly, I go to bed every night afraid for my children's future. And that really struck me. This is America. A mother is going to bed afraid for her children's future. And the reason she's afraid for her children's future is because we've had problems for a long time. Yes, problems have gotten much worse under Democrats.
I'm at a loss for words. No, this is why I can't stand politicians. The guy was so specific. He's like, well, if you look back at the job numbers, you have the Clinton creating this much and Bush creating that much. And how will you answer the charge that the Democrats have been better? She's like, well, thank you for that question. I like how I just made Carly slightly British as well. Thank you for that question. That reminds me of a story I heard about somebody who I don't give a fuck about, but I'm going to pretend to give a fuck about. This is an anecdotal story that I can't prove, nor should I be able to. I'm just going to talk out of my ass because I don't have any actual substance, statistics, numbers, facts to give you. So let me tell you about a friend of a friend who told me some shit. No, it's so calculated and it's so fake and it's oozing insincerity. And if I was the moderator, man, I'd be putting a gun to my head. I'm like, you should answer the fucking question. Answer the fucking question. But you can't answer the question. And that's the point, guys, and that's why we're doing this segment. She has to answer like that. Why do you have to answer like that? Well, think about it. What was his question? His question was, okay, well, you know, your opponents are going to say the Democrats are better with the economy. Here are the numbers, proving, indeed, that they are better with the economy. So how do you answer that if you're a Republican? Now, Fiorina knew she was going to not answer that going into it, but if you actually had to answer that question, if you're a Republican, what is the answer? Here, I'll give it to you. That's your answer. Why? Because you can't respond to that. It's true. So let me give you more specifics. George W. Bush, now, he created 13,000 jobs a month on average in his administration. That may be true, but it's only true if you include public sector jobs. That's right. So if you include the government jobs that Bush added, because he says, oh, I'm a small government servant, he's not. He grew the government tremendously. So how many private sector jobs did Bush give us? He net lost 646,000. Guys, that's unheard of. That's stunningly bad. Just to give you context on that, Jimmy Carter, who's, you know, roundly considered by many to say, oh, he wasn't that good of a president because of the economy when he was in office. We had the gas shortage and stagflation. He created a million jobs. Bush lost 646,000! So, okay, but well, yeah, whatever, compared to Clinton, he was a disaster. Clinton created 20.8 million. Now, you could say he was riding the internet bubble, and that's true. That's true. But nonetheless, there was a net creation from when he was in office to when he left. 20.8 million, Bush lost 646,000 private sector jobs. And then when you look at Obama today, created 13 million. He inherited the Great Recession and the subprime mortgage crisis, created 13 million. When you look at the deficit, because we're Republicans, well, we're better on the deficit. Wrong. Clinton gave us a surplus of a little over $200 billion. Bush left us with a record deficit, $1.4 trillion. Obama's cut that to about $483 billion. So whether you're talking about the deficit or you're talking about private sector job creation, the Democrats are better, and that goes further back. You can go any time post-World War II, you look at it, and probably even further back because FDR was the one who saved the country from the Great Depression. But everything post-World War II, Reagan ballooned the deficit tremendously, left us a recession. He had a net creation of jobs, but still a lot of that went pop when he left office because it was fake creation of wealth because he deregulated and cut taxes for the rich. So the Democrats simply win on the job scorecard. So therefore, when you're asked a direct question about how are you going to respond to that, what's her answer? Let me tell you about my friend's friend in Idaho who said some shit and did some shit and blah, blame the Democrats. Facts, numbers? What are facts and numbers? I don't know. Let me continue to bullshit you. All right, now we go to Neil Cavuto for the last one of the debate. Neil Cavuto asked a classic Republican debate question last night. Let's watch.
First of all, Dr. Carson, to you, you say you are in favor of a tax system, I guess akin to tithing, sir, with a flat tax rate of up to 15%, because you said if everybody pays this, I think God is a pretty fair guy, so tithing is a pretty fair process. But Donald Trump said that is not fair, that wealthier taxpayers should pay a higher rate because it's a fair thing to do. So whose plan would God endorse then, doctor? Yours? Or Mr. Trump?
Well, you know, when I say tithing, I'm talking about the concept of proportionality.
Right.
Everybody should pay the same proportion of what they make. You make $10 billion, you pay $1 billion. You make $10, you pay $1. You get the same rights and privileges. I don't see how anything gets a whole lot fairer than that.
In the first debate, they asked a similar question. They said, has God spoken to any of you guys? Now they say, well, which tax plan would God prefer? Can you imagine that question being asked at a Democratic debate? No, answer, of course not. Why? Because they're serious human beings. Even the ones who I'm not that fond of. You know, I look at Hillary Clinton, I see a massive sellout to the establishment, and she's going to continue business as usual. She'll be, at best, a center-right corporatist Democrat. But that's not even, she wouldn't be like, what are you saying? What does that mean? What are you doing? God? You want to bring God into this conversation. Now stop and think how Americans would react if that question was asked in any other country. Imagine that was asked in Iran. Does Allah support your trade plan? What would we look at that and go, what do you mean? Is it a reasonable question being asked in a debate? No. Look at these fucking primitive little children. And guess what? That response would be right. It would be correct. It's proper. You're going to ask what Allah wants you to know? You don't fucking know. Nobody knows. How does the old saying go? If you talk to God, you're religious. If God talks to you, you're a psychopath. You're a paranoid schizophrenic. We got to get you on Thorazine or Seroquel. ASAP. You hearing voices in your head, son? That's not normal. Cavuto, whose tax plan would God support? I don't know. Have you called God's accountant recently? I hear Moses knows a guy who could tell somebody about the burning bush where... Enough with children, fairy tales. Could you imagine if there was some sort of a debate in ancient Rome? Have the gods spoken on your decision about what to do with the aquifers? What does that mean? Does it mean anything? You've all bought into the Mother Goose fairy tales of your time. But even with that being said, I'll answer your question. So Ben Carson says, well, tithing. It's in the Bible, so that's that. End of conversation. Except what's he missing? He's missing that. Okay, so his idea is in the Bible, there's some religious support for it. What's the central message of the Bible, specifically the New Testament, but the Bible broadly speaking, on issues of economics? Now, on virtually every topic, the Bible is totally contradictory. You can support war and genocide and slavery and all types of horrific stuff with the Bible. That's all that's in there. But there's some other issues where it's not contradictory. There aren't really two sides. There's one side to it. One of those things is immigration, where you're supposed to treat the sojourner, as they call you in the Bible, good no matter what. Are the Republicans pro-immigrant? Yeah, so they're a little unbiblical there. But on economics, are you kidding me? Jesus was a communist before communism existed. Let me give you some details on this, not just from the New Testament, also some from the Old Testament here. Luke 18:25. For it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of God. Let me decode that. If you're rich, you ain't getting into heaven. James 5, lines 1 through 6. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire. In layman's terms, you're rich, you're going to hell. End of conversation. Story of Lazarus in the Bible as well. Same thing. If you're rich, just because you were rich on earth, they say, well, you had a nice existence on earth. Now that, you know, you died, you're going to hell. The poor are going to inherit the kingdom of God, not you. Flat out anti-rich. Anti-rich. All right, more. Luke 12:33. Sell your possessions and give to the needy. Is that Ben? Is Ben Carson's tax plan account for that? No, you have to pay ten. If you make $50,000 a year, pay 10% of your money. If you make $5 billion a year, pay 10%. Right, because Jesus would be in favor of that. Revelation 3:17. For you say, I am rich, I have prospered, and I need nothing, not realizing that you are wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, and naked. Again, anti-rich, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. So if you really want to have a conversation about Christian tax plans, you might want to start the conversation with Das Kapital. All right. How much time I got left? All right, let me try to squeeze in two more. Do my best here. Let's do Veterans Day. So on Veterans Day, I usually talk about what it really means to support the troops, and this Veterans Day is going to be no different. Now, whenever you hear the phrase support the troops, what's the first thing that comes to mind? I know for me, I have flashbacks to the 2004 election when the Bush campaign said about Kerry, he doesn't support the troops. When Republicans were saying about Democrats all around the country, they don't support the troops. And their argument was what? Their argument was, well, you're not in favor of the Iraq war, so obviously you don't support the troops. Think about how ridiculous that is. I mean, use that in the context of Vietnam. Well, you don't support sending more American soldiers to Vietnam to die for no good reason? Well, I guess you hate the troops. No. If anything, the opposite is true. You hate the troops for sending them to go die for no good reason. Now, the argument was, if we don't fight communism in Vietnam, well, goddammit, it's going to spread like a virus. Next thing you know, they'll be knocking on your door in Kentucky. Except that was made up. That wasn't going to happen. It was just fear of the Soviet boogeyman. So we fought the war, and over 50,000 U.S. soldiers died. It was a waste. It was a waste. They should have never been sent there to die in the first place. And it's pro-troop to say that, not anti-troop. So they recycled the same bullshit argument that's been used historically. And liberals, of course, didn't effectively fight back. They tried, no, tell me for the war and the troops, because you put them together, so I'm just going to take the bait. When they should have counter-argued, but they didn't. So now to this day, we still have remnants of people making that argument. Oh, you don't support sending troops back into Iraq or being involved in Syria or wherever. Well, then I guess you don't support the troops. You're against the troops. No. It's time to end this once and for all. The real way to support the troops is to value their human life and only send them into harm's way when it is absolutely necessary. So I want to go ahead and give you a brief history, a partial history, I should say, of the interventions we've done, either bombing or other interventions, post-World War II. So you get a sense of how involved the U.S. has been around the world since then, and whether or not this is a good thing, and whether or not this is pro-troop. Now, if I repeat these places here, it's because we've been there more than once. So we've either bombed or intervened in, post-World War II, China, Korea, China again, Guatemala, Indonesia, Cuba, Guatemala again, Belgian Congo, Guatemala again, Dominican Republic, Peru, Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, Guatemala again, Lebanon, Grenada, Libya, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Iran, Libya again, Panama, Iraq, Kuwait, Somalia, Bosnia, Iran, Sudan, Afghanistan, Yugoslavia, and Serbia, Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq again. Okay, that's a lot of fucking places. And again, that's a partial list. Now, not only that, who else have we supported? Yet again, I just want to be clear, this is a partial list. These are authoritarian regimes we've supported, undemocratic regimes, regimes that are anti-freedom, because I know the neocons love to say, well, when we go around the world, we're supporting freedom, we're supporting democracy, that's why we're getting involved. Really? Then why do you support dictators? Why do you support authoritarian regimes? Why do you support regimes that crack down on freedom? All right, just to give some examples, we supported the dictators Diaz, Batista, Somoza, Duvalier, Pinochet, Diem, Marcos, Mobutu, Ceausescu, the royal Saudi family, the Sultan of Oman, Mbasogo of Guinea. Some of these, by the way, I haven't even heard of. Berdy Muhammadov of Turkmenistan. Guys, the list is endless here. And What did the troops get for this? What did they get for this? 57,849 of them are homeless. That is as of 2013. It may have improved slightly today, but it's still an unacceptable number. 57,849. So these people were told you're protecting freedom around the world. You're doing the right thing. You're protecting order. You're upholding international law. That's what they're told. You're the good guys. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to send you to invade all these different places. And, oh, would you look at that? You actually went in there, and as a result of what you did, the ruling class can take their natural resources. And also we propped up authoritarian regimes, anti-freedom regimes, undemocratic regimes. So they're used as pawns in this global chessboard of imperialism. And then when they come back, over 57,000 homeless. They use you, and then they don't even respect you when you're back home. Let me give you more. Republicans cut food stamps for 900,000. 900,000 vets were affected by a food stamp cut from the Republicans. Go fight for the corporations and to spread U.S. imperialism. Fight to keep undemocratic regimes in place, and then come back. I'm going to cut your food stamps. I'm going to gut your social safety net programs. Your home's going to be gone. I'm not going to sufficiently help you. And, oh, yeah, by the way, there's a backlog at the VA where you get your health care, and the Republicans filibustered a bill proposed by the Democrats to create 27 new VA clinics, which would have stopped that backlog. Tell me again who's pro-troop. Tell me again who's anti-troop. Listen, guys, the troops are people. They're human beings. You know how you support them? You know, if I was a soldier, you know how I would like to be supported? I would want you to scream from the fucking rooftops and go nuts if I'm ever sent into a place where I shouldn't fucking be, or if I'm only going there for Honeywell and Boeing and GE and Halliburton and ExxonMobil and other multinational corporations that get rich off of this in the military-industrial complex. I would want you to say, you're never fucking sending these poor men and women ever, ever on my watch unless it's to defend the nation from imminent attack, like, for example, it was in World War II, which was a totally just war. That's how you protect the troops. I'm the one that's pro-troop, okay? If you're a Republican and you support all these interventions, you're against the troops. All right, I love you guys. That'll do it for today. Got a bunch of stuff to get to tomorrow. Didn't get to three stories here, but I promise we will do them tomorrow. You have my word, yo. All right, everybody have a great night. We'll see you then. Peace.